Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Hey, it's the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 304. New stuff happening over at the Nerdist YouTube channel, youtube.com/Nerdist. It's Neil Patrick Harris' show, Neil's Puppet Dreams. We have a few more new episodes left of this season, so go watch it now. Then click subscribe, because I'm asking you to, because I'm your friend, right? Right? You'd click a digital button for me, wouldn't you? What? Fuck me. All right, I would like to thank, well, maybe I shouldn't go into the sponsorship segment after saying fuck me. So just for a second, puppy smell and chocolate. And I'd like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Think about how much time you've wasted at the post office. Just shut your eyes, not if you're driving, but shut your eyes and just think, all that time, you could just get it back. Doing what? I don't know. It's going on Amazon to buy exercise things you might not use, or taking a deep dive down Wikipedia, the Star Wars wiki. Who knows what you could have done, what you could have invented with all the time you wasted at the post office. Don't do it anymore. Stamps.com is the better way to get postage. You just use what you already have, your computer, your printer, and then you don't have to drive anywhere. You print out exactly the postage you need. Your mail carrier will come and pick it up from your place, and that's it. It's done. And you look professional, which is cool. Even if you're sending personal stuff, it makes you seem better than your friends. And isn't that what we all want? So right now, there's a special offer. Use the promo code Nerdist. Go to stamps.com. You're going to click on the radio microphone at the top of the page and type in Nerdist. You get a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale up to $55 of free postage. That's stamps.com, and enter the promo code Nerdist. And now this very episode you're about to consume orally. It is Timothy Oliphant, who has been in a lot of stuff that I've really liked a lot. Justified's great. Fucking Deadwood. They should have just called it fucking Deadwood. A ton of other stuff, that a lot of which we cover in the podcast. But I learned some stuff about him that I didn't know before, which kind of blew my mind, which I'm not going to spoil now, because then why would you listen to it? So listen, it comes at some point in the podcast between the beginning and the end. I'm not going to tell you, so you don't jump to it. I want to make you go through the process. I know, I'm such a dictator. But this is really, really fun. I would like to remind you that Justified premieres January 8th. It'll be on FX Tuesdays at 10 p.m. So watch that show, because it's fucking awesome. And my pal Walton Goggins is also on that show, who I should also get on this podcast as well. All right, I'll take care of that behind the scenes. Here we go, the Nerdist Podcast episode number 304 with Timothy Oliphant.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
And we're recording. That's it.
Thanks for coming.
Wow, we're in.
That's it, man.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, we're in. So these microphones, you sort of have to almost put your mouth on them. They're just I'm sure you...
And speak into it. You also have to do that.
Yeah. I appreciate the opportunity to put my mouth on it.
Have you had to do a lot of radio tours? Are you about to start doing that?
What's the option on the earphones?
You don't have to have them.
I can't stand them.
Don't put them on.
You enjoy that?
I do, because I can hear it. I can just make sure the levels are okay.
And also very narcissistic.
It's all about the levels.
Yeah.
Also very oh.
I just love my buttery voice.
One time I walked in here and it was just him by himself going, ooh.
Yeah.
No, I'm Jack Barry.
And you were sitting on a bass amp?
I was sitting on a bass amp. Yeah. Like in Private Parts.
Yes.
Is that what you were referencing? The Howard Stern movie?
Yeah.
Very clever.
Thank you.
Matt Myra could not be here because he is hosting the very last attack of the show today.
Oh.
I know. G4 is going away. But, Tim, it is an honor to meet you.
This is a quick segue from something so tragic.
Oh, yeah. His show's going away. A lot of people out of work at Christmas time. But, Tim, let's talk about Deadwood.
All right. Another show that's no longer with us.
Oh, man. Can I just say that, first of all, clearly... And I'm sure people bug you about the show all the time, so I apologize for being typical in this way. But one of the best shows on television ever. And I held off watching the very last episode for a year.
Really?
Because I didn't want it to be over. And I knew that once I watched it, I was going to be upset because I wasn't going to get any resolution on it. So I held it for a year.
Same reason I'm not going to watch Attack of the Show today. Is that the only reason? That and the same reason I didn't watch any of the others. No, that's terrible. That's not right. I went on that show, Attack of the Show. It was...
You didn't watch that episode either, did you?
No, but I was there. I was very present, and I remember it fondly. Right? That's the one with the girl who's everywhere.
Olivia.
Yeah, she
left to go be everywhere.
Fantastic. And I remember thinking when I went on that show, first I remember thinking, what the fuck am I doing here? And what is this? Not in a high pretentious way. I just didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And then I remember sitting down with this girl thinking, gosh, she's fantastic. What is she doing here? She should be elsewhere.
She was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, she's she's had her eye on the prize, didn't she? Had her eye on the prize. Well, God bless her. She should.
She got it.
She's very talented.
Yeah, Attack of the Show is interesting for, especially if you're used to doing a lot of press, a lot of you know, like cable interviews or local shows and.
Yeah.
You don't do a lot of those.
No, I mean, but anyway, continue.
Well, I'm saying like when I, like, you know, especially like when I'm traveling on the road and I'm doing stand-up and you go do like their morning TV show, there's always a dynamic that you're immediately dropped into and you're trying to suss out like, okay, that's the guy who wears the crazy ties. That guy takes his job too seriously. There's the weather girl that wants to be an anchor. Like there's always some sort of a weird, you just feel like you're in someone's house and you don't know their family.
No, it happens in an instant, right? Because you get a sense of it's about to happen, you know, like be off camera, whatever that is.
Yeah.
It's like talking to morning radio.
Exactly.
You get on the phone and they say, hey, how you doing? It's good to appreciate you doing this. And we're a big fan, whatever they say. And then they're like, you ready? Here we go. And they're like, hey, we're sitting down here with Timothy Olyphant. Yeah. Tell me, Jennifer Garner, nice tits.
Yeah. And try not to swear.
You're like, what happened? Like, what just happened? How did you just go to that?
Hey. Where was the personable guy I was just talking to? Where did he go?
Yeah.
Hey, I got to know, did you fuck Ian McShane? Yeah. What are we talking about?
Exactly. It just goes right to that.
And it's a million inside jokes that you don't get. And you're like,
no.
Yeah, that's like a little dickhead over there. We sent him over with a case of Keystone.
And it's like, ling, 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 ling. And you're like, wow, we won something.
What the fuck is happening?
Who's going to Hawaii?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all nuts, though, all those morning
guys. And TV, radio, it's all the same. It all kind of just throws me every time. It doesn't matter how many times. I've never had that. Not had the feeling of what the fuck am I doing here? I mean, honestly, everyone, I think to myself, this is.
Yeah.
Well, it's because I
gotta be a better way.
Yeah. You have had the feeling, it's like, do I even care enough about this?
Yes. Because there's a lot of it makes you feel like, and it's just a function of they have to produce a television thing or a radio thing every day. It's usually live. They have to fill time. And so you just feel like, I'm a prop that is killing 5 minutes of your show.
Yeah.
You know, like there's very little humanity in any of it. And you just feel like, what? Why don't you just pull out a prop box?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
But from that part, like
and
it is.
America can't get enough of it.
They fucking love it.
Can't get enough of it. And I love being part of the problem.
I did a. Sort of ties into Justify a little bit, but I did the Chelsea show last night, and one of the topics that was on the panel was there's a rise in hillbilly porn because of shows like Honey Boo Boo and the Duck Dynasty and Swamp People. Like, America's so fascinated with hillbillies and rednecks right now that theme has crossed over into porn, and they're like hillbilly themed porn.
It does tie into Justify.
A little bit.
I just saw dollar signs. I just saw wow. Ratings are going to be huge this year.
Do you ever think for a minute you're like, okay, look, I would never do this, but
I'm going to send Boo Boo's mom a Christmas card.
But
say,
if
thank you.
But if you and Walton Goggins and like if everyone like really great actors got together, you could make the best fucking porn in the history of cinema. And make a killing.
No, you wouldn't make a killing because no porn seems to make money. They just it goes online and everyone just watches it there.
You know, I was in until that, and exactly. that, until you brought it down
Girl
so
Next
quick.
Door.
Also, can't
because I just thought to myself, wait a minute, Chris is onto something, and then you just crashed it.
And you can't do it in California because you have to wear
Walt
condoms.
As I was texting him, literally texting him, like, dude, listen to this. And then you said, "There's no money in it," and I said, like, forget it.
Never mind.
Just forget it.
Yeah, well, I loved Girl Next Door, by the way. I thought that was
a great movie.
It was a really fun movie.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's weird because I didn't, like, it was one of those movies where the ad campaign was completely different from what the movie actually was. Like, I remember seeing it going, thinking it was just, like, this kind of madcap, you know, guy dates a porn star. And then I was working at a movie theater at the time, so I went and saw it. And I was like, this is an amazing, this is, like, really well done.
Total
the
homage.
Music's great.
Total
like,
homage to Risky Business, in my opinion.
Yeah. Homage is a polite way of putting it. But it was good. I enjoyed being a part of that. I had a good time.
I'm just going to list off a bunch of other movies that I loved you in. Go, fucking awesome movie.
Yeah.
John August.
Good guy.
Doug Liman,
a little Melissa McCarthy cameo in that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
She comes on
for like 2 minutes and steals the movie. I mean, she's amazingly funny in this little tiny bit.
Yeah.
Amazing.
She's like one of the best scenes in This Is 40. She's what, like, has one scene and she just steals the movie.
She usually does that.
Yeah.
Wherever she is, she's got that Will Ferrell thing where wherever she is on screen, you just kind of go, I just need to watch. Yeah.
Explosively funny.
I need to watch more of her.
Yeah.
When you sort of look back at everything.
That was the end of the list, by the way.
It's just those four movies.
I just want to make sure I'm being clear. I didn't interrupt you from going on in the list.
No.
That was just, you start feeding him the movie. Well, there's also, I have
I've
also
done at least 15. I could check the IMDb page,
enjoyed
me. I feel like there was a lot of them.
No, I think it was just those couple.
I think it was just those
have
couple.
You done other stuff?
Yes, the worst. Yeah. It's amazing. That's the list, and yet I've been working for a long fucking time.
I don't think so.
It's like professional baseball. you hit one, you know, 2 out of 10. You're still pretty good.
No. Listen, honestly, like first of all, it's amazing to be able to work for extended period of time in this business, and then to have like, you know, a bunch of good stuff is like. That to me is just like, how does that? That's so rare that even happens. I mean, how many actors do you know that you're like, that guy's really good, never really got a thing though. Just
never thought of that. Sure,
never really got a thing.
Although you know, you're persistent, you stick around. You know, you every time they've always everyone's been in something where you're like that. If they've been around that long, they tend to have been in like he was great in that thing.
Yeah,
you know.
It's never
it's like a currency, an amazing currency when someone is just, as long as they've been good at one point, been given that opportunity, then they work another 4 or 5 years, no problem.
Based off of that.
I could be wrong, but I feel like, no, like on my experience on the show and Justified, we have actors that come on and you're like, this guy's great. And then you look at the list and you're like, yeah, he was great in that. And he was great. There's,
yeah. Breaking Bad's the same way.
They've been around. They're usually in something good.
That's happening. Good. That's happening with the cable shows now, is that cable shows are absorbing these fucking amazing acts, like pulling in. Who's on season two of Justified? Margot Martindale.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Goddamn. You're like in Parija Tem.
Yeah.
Or just the Alexander Payne directed thing. Like, it's, you can't watch that and not sob because she's so fucking amazing in it.
Yeah.
And Walton's great. And then you look at, like American Horror Story has got like Ian McShane and Jessica Lange and fucking Sarah Paulson and all these really amazing actors, and
it's great.
It's like a golden age in cable television.
But even Breaking Bad's like that too, where it's like you're watching these guys, and then you go, wait a minute, that guy was in Free Jack and RoboCop 2, and you just start to realize they've just been working for years.
It's all the people that networks would go, that everyone knows is amazing, but networks go, they can't sell a show. And then so they get passed over for these dumb network shows, and then cable goes, okay, we'll take the best actors that are available today.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always, I remember hearing this years ago. You get a good script, you get a good part, you're in a great spot because there's so many good, talented actors. There's just so many. Cut. That was a good show.
This has been,
I just brought it down to nothing. Go back to your enthusiasm about whatever show we're talking about.
Do you prefer working on TV because it's like you just kind of are set for a while with work, or do you kind of miss sometimes the freelancy jumping from one movie to the next?
It never gets as good as when you first get a job. And so as much as you like, I love this part. I love, and it's not lost on me how good a gig this is. I do recognize that it's still never as good as when you first get the job.
Yeah.
And so it goes a little bit both ways.
So it becomes a job in a way.
You know, the reason this job is so good is it hasn't become that. I mean, it hasn't become that. And it's still thrilling, and it's still a fun story to tell. I've kind of gotten away with something on this job because I've basically forced my way into the kitchen and been a part of, you know, the storytelling, and that keeps it endlessly entertaining and
that's
challenging.
Great.
Yeah, so that's been, that's sort of what I've gotten away with on this one.
You getting producer credits on that?
I do, yeah.
Nice.
I like what you said before about that it's not, you'd sort of alluded to the fact that it's people who've been around who managed to survive and stay relevant. Because I think when you're a young performer, young actor, comedian, whatever, kind of have this idea in your head like, oh, I'm going to get that one job and then everything's going to change. And then you get a job and you think that's going to be it. And then that's not the thing. And then the next job and that's not the thing. And then you realize I feel like I realize after a while is like, no, it's the body of work that tips it. It's the sum total of you have to do that thing like 100 times before.
Yeah. One could argue you don't want that thing.
You don't want it right away.
You don't.
No.
I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. I mean, if you could just do the job, I guess that would be lovely. But that kind of success, you know, pick up People magazine, lots of shit comes with it.
Well, I think it's the, you know, like when someone gets famous really fast, like one job hits really big right away, there's not a foundation of work behind it.
Yeah.
And so the next thing that they do, it's just they're so set up for failure because if that next thing isn't amazing, everyone's like, fuck that guy. And then they just sort of
down. I've seen it. I mean, you know, I've worked with, I was that person at one point. I'd like to think I'm not anymore, but I've been on jobs where I'm with some young guy who's, he's really like on the verge of being this huge star and hasn't a clue what he's doing. And it's really remarkable to watch. You can see you can feel underneath the excitement a sense of complete and utter confusion about what the fuck is happening.
Yeah.
And has no sense of how to handle it, how to behave, what to try to do, you know, and in such a position of power and control and excitement and being the next thing. And honestly, doesn't know, his ass from a hole in the ground on the set. And it's, you're like, wow, he's about to be the next big guy.
Yeah.
And you the next 10 years just flash right in front of you where you're like, wow, he's done. You know, and he's in rehab. I mean, 5 years maybe?
Yeah.
Because he has no sense of what to do with all of this excitement.
What would you say to that guy? Like, if he said, Tim, I feel like this thing is brewing and I don't know what to do. How do I handle all this? Is it even possible in that situation?
Would they even have the foresight to say that?
But if they did,
yeah.
First like, I'd have to ask him to come out of his trailer and say, I think in the end of the day, it's what you were saying before. You have to realize what's real, and I think in the end of the day, you just have to ask yourself, do you, it's all about the craft of my wife and I were talking about this last night. You know, you go to these premieres and you're hanging out with big shots and the craziness and all the drama underneath. And we're driving home. She goes, you know, sometimes I realize I'm talking to these people and they have no idea that they're just doing a job. You know what I mean? They're just
not caring anything.
They're just working for a living.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that gets lost in all of it oftentimes.
Yeah.
That you're just basically more or less a carpenter. And you either know what you're doing or you don't. And if you don't know what you're doing, and there's very few other jobs where you can be really bad at your job and still shoot straight to the top. And this
on is, every level.
On every level. And this is one of them, you know. And I think that's, the best thing you can do is just make a decision if you're going to try to be good at your job. Because the other thing is, as you can see, is very hard to maintain. Without destroying yourself.
Sure.
I mean, you can maintain it to some degree, some level of success, but it's exhausting, I imagine, anyway.
And also, I feel like you don't have to play that game. I mean, it's not like, you know, I don't see Matt Damon in every People magazine. I don't see you in all the Us magazines. And it's not that, it's just because, like, those people that are in those magazines, I feel a lot of them sort of want that to happen.
It does seem like a choice.
It feels a little bit like a choice. Like if you're a person and your publicist calls and says, yeah, this person's going to go to Kitson and buy hats and then all the paparazzi show up. Like you don't have to be in all that tabloid shit.
No, but
you have to make
a decision to have something else to offer.
Yeah.
And that's hard work.
I guess it is. I mean, the difficult part is that because of what we do, I think it's finding a measurement system of success. And because what we do is a public thing, there's a certain degree of like, oh, I'm more successful if more people know who I am when I go out in pub. And like, and that sort of fucks with your,
Cause
you're the product. You don't make a thing. This thing that goes into the ether is the product.
Yeah, success isn't fame. Success is just working.
Success
and being
is working.
Good at what you do.
And people get, they fall
into
it.
It's really hard. I mean, it's honestly very difficult. If you have some sense of, if you do a film and then you go out and sell that film and go to a premiere and you walk that red carpet and you have agents on all that stuff and everything's extremely important. Everything is like, it has such a level of, your everyday conversations with agents and everything, everything's a big fucking deal. Yeah. And then you walk the red carpet and you're being asked these, the flashbulbs and it's a big fucking deal. And the next day is so thankless.
Yeah.
That it's hard not to go, maybe I'll go shoplift or something. Yeah. Something just to keep this up.
Yeah.
This level of excitement.
Chase the dragon.
It's really hard not to think to yourself, do I have to destroy something in my life in order to create that excitement again? Because I mean, it's such a drug that you're coming off of. It's very difficult.
And then also sort of weird when, I just boil it down to the idea of like, okay, you can walk a red carpet and people are screaming and then you get it, whatever, like, oh, Tim, hey, whatever. And then the next day, it's like you said, but you know, you're just alone in your place,
yeah,
taking a crap, and you're just like, I don't, what happened?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't know what happens.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, even like our friend Howard Kermit's comic always, he talks about that a lot, where it's like, he's like, you'll be at a show killing in front of like, you know, like 700 people, and you're a god to them because you're just making them laugh, and then he's all, and then you go home and you have to hold your girlfriend's hair because she's puking because she got the stomach flu.
Exactly.
And you're just there and you're just like, well, exactly, this is a lot of fame here.
Still waving to a fake crowd, yes, while you, yes, hold it. Hey, everybody. Yeah. But I guess it is, it's a sort of a biological need for significance that everyone has. And that's like, when you get a taste of that, I think there is, you know, you have to be strong enough, or at least just have the right mindset to be like, yeah, you know, that's fine. But because to a degree it matters, in the sense of, if you want to keep working, unfortunately, you know, producers give a shit about that.
Years ago, just well over 10 years ago or so, something had gone on in my career where there was a great deal of level of excitement, or that I was feeling or getting or whatever was going on. And I remember trying to kind of wrap my head around it, talking to a close friend of mine. And this person said, interrupted me and said, you know, it's not about you. And I said, yeah, no, I know about what I'm saying. He goes, no, no, but it's not about you. And I said, yeah, no, I get that. I'm just, and he goes, no, no, Tim, listen to me. It has nothing to do with you. And it took, honestly, even like the third or fourth time, I still was like, yeah, I understand it, but it does a little bit. Yeah. Right? I mean, I know what you're saying, yeah, but I mean, yes, I understand, yeah, that as a metaphor, but it does. I mean, let's admit it, it does, right?
Yeah.
And I swear to God, this person was like practically bracing me down and sitting me in a chair saying, no, it's actually not about you at all. And somewhere at fourth or fifth time, I remember thinking, fuck, it's not about me. it was very memorable, you know, a thing. To,
you're,
you
lucky
know,
you
someone
had that person.
Had someone,
yeah,
that said that to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm reminded of that often.
How do you, like, when you're...
I still don't think I totally get that.
I think what that friend
I think that friend has it mostly right, and it's good that person's around.
No, because well, if you're really narcissistic, what you think is like, yeah, that guy's just jealous because shit's going,
yeah, exactly,
on. Like,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I think
needless to say, we're not on speaking
terms. We're not on speaking terms. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is about me.
yeah.
But I think the underlying message of that is that there is a machine in place. And people need to consume something, and if it's not you, it's gonna be something else.
Yeah,
so
be new too.
So it is about you in the sense that you're the thing that they're focused on now, but it's not necessarily the essence of who you are.
Yeah,
I'm guessing that's.
I'm
probably
guessing
what
that
it is.
The you would think that the those prince and princesses over there in England have a sense of that.
A little bit.
Yes. Yeah. That there's just no way it's about them.
Right.
No.
They're. Right? I mean, how could it be?
Right. They're props, basically. They were born, yeah, into this weird thing.
And serve a very useful purpose for everybody. I mean, they really, quite honestly, they do.
When you think
I
about
mean
it.
That in the most sincere
really?
Way.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No different than General Hospital or any of those other shows. You,
yeah,
know, you gotta have someone to live vicariously.
Well, they're emotional. Yeah, they're emotional. Yeah, they're emotional, yeah, symbols.
You need someone to put up there and go, look. They got, they going through a whole thing there that we can
you
live through and fantasize through.
You
and
don't got a soul. You're just here as a vessel for my, yeah.
You gotta have something there to, you know, you.
At least they were born into it, as opposed to, like, you know, like, American
born
royalty.
Royalty, quote unquote.
Yeah.
I always love what Louis C.K. said, where it was like someone in an interview, and someone was like, you're the biggest comic in America. And he goes, maybe right now, but probably not in a couple of years. Like, he just understood. Like, he just understands. Yeah. Like, yeah, fine. Yeah. Things are great right now. Yeah. Who in a couple of years, if, yeah, it could be someone else.
Well, he's the guy that saw, yeah, it happen to all his friends. You know, become, yeah, the biggest comic, and then
success,
they're not.
Success later on. I think success in your 40s is a great time to have that, because to be able to have failed enough where, when something comes along, it doesn't mean everything. I Bill Maher said once that his idea of success was, you know, when you get the call for the big show that you're going to get, you're just like, oh, okay, great. Like, there's no, Which is sad in a way that you don't really celebrate as much, but you've just, I mean, do you feel that it's hard to get excited about things because you've just been through it for so much?
I get pretty excited about not getting excited. You know, I really,
it's a weirdly powerful thing.
I was, and, this person is literally, you called Maria, lovely woman behind you there, who is a publicist, and, Maria called me last week. So last week when you called and you said, hey, if you get nominated tomorrow morning, do you want me to call you or email you? And I said, nominated for what? And she said, well, the SAG and the Golden Globe Awards are coming out in the next tomorrow and the next day. And I said, all right, you just ruined my fucking morning. because I would have slept peacefully, you know, not because I had no clue.
Yeah.
And maybe I shouldn't have had a clue. I mean, but anyway, I'm getting the, you know, the phone call. But I remember thinking, oh, that's cool. I had no idea. That's a good sign. But the really good sign was when I slept peacefully through the morning, and not until late in the afternoon did I see something online about the Golden Globe nominations. And I said, oh, I guess I didn't get nominated. So I really didn't, you know, I didn't wake up in the morning and say, I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to my wife, I forgot. I didn't know they were coming, and then when I found out, I forgot. I said, I've always wanted to be that guy.
Yeah. That's kind of cool.
And I was like, apparently, now I'm that guy. I had no clue.
Because,
and that was a nice feeling.
Because you want to tell people, like, listen, you don't want to be desperate, and you don't want to seem needy, but it's very hard to shut that shit off, because the only way to shut that shit off is by just being comfortable with who you are, and you cannot force comfort. You just can't force it. You just have to grow into it, or just be that way, or have a certain brain chemistry, I guess.
It didn't occur to me before until just now that we are possibly the most grounded, well-balanced people in show business.
There's no question that
had no idea.
This is a cadre of enlightened, like, we are some type of rare Illuminati.
It feels like this is about to become a call-in show, not unlike a Dr. Drew kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's only actors like, calling in.
It's not sex problems. It's just like emotional scrapes that they've got.
Yeah, they call in and we just say, just keep at it.
Yeah.
Keep working on the craft. Persistence. It's all about persistence.
Hey, I have my second callback for Modern Family.
Just don't think about it. Just don't think about it.
Don't think about it. Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Walk in that door and think to yourself, you know what? Maybe something nice will happen here.
Yeah.
It's not about getting the job, but maybe just there'll be a moment and you leave. It's fine.
I so loathe the audition process. I just don't do it anymore.
I do it when I want to feel bad about myself.
It sucks to feel bad about yourself about things you didn't even want in the first place. Yeah. You're like, this is terrible. And then you audition and you're like, what do you mean they didn't like me? You're like,
it's like asking out a girl you don't really think is pretty and then she rejects you and you go, what? No, you don't do that to me.
Yeah.
Hey, come on, come back here.
Yeah.
That's always a fun thing when you call up and you say, listen, I got the material. I have some notes. I have some concerns. I have some questions. And then the response is they want to know if you'll read for it. And you're like, well, it puts me in a tough position to ask my questions and concerns or give them notes if I'm having to read for it.
Yeah, you're going
to
read on tape with casting.
What?
Just some dude, some intern in a camera in a room.
Call back and tell him to offer it to me so I can tell him what I don't like about it.
Tell him not for me so I can tell him no.
Exactly.
How can I tell him what I don't like about it if I'm having to audition for the process for the
don't
fucking
they
job?
Understand how this works?
All right, so let me get this right.
What do you mean it's not about me?
I have to put aside my problems, put aside my criticisms, try really hard to get the job, hoping they'll offer it to me so then I can criticize them.
Okay, give me the director on the phone.
Yeah.
I got to tell him.
That's my goal now. I'm going to get this fucking job, and then I'm going to tell him what I don't like about it.
Yeah.
That's the motivation.
When the director asks, what's your motivation? Making this better.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the, it's, what besides Justified, what's the other thing that people always... here's a question that I want to start asking people now is what is the one question that you're tired of getting? Like in every interview, there's three or four questions, and I'm sure there are one or two that are the exact same questions every time. What's yours?
I don't know. It's nothing about specific about jobs. That's always lovely if someone says, you know, like what you did is it's quite the compliment to talk about something I did 10, 15, 20 years ago or whatever, or some movie that kind of breeze through and it still has a life. It's lovely. And you'd think I would have figured this out now, but I literally kind of just go dead when someone says, tell me about your character. And I honestly, and I have said this out loud on some occasions, and this hasn't gone well, where I literally will say, you know, you tell me. I don't want to talk about the character. Who the fuck cares about the character?
That question is basically, the undertone of that question is, I haven't seen the thing you're working on.
I don't know what it is.
And I don't know. I don't have any specific things to ask about. So that's a very broad, describe the thing to me.
It says, like, I mean, honestly, I realize I don't have to answer that question. And I can answer whatever question I want.
Yeah.
And they're just starting a conversation. But I find it almost, and again, this is my problem. But I find it almost offensive. Tell me about your character. Tell me what the show's about. Tell me what's different this season than last. Where do we have whatever? And I always want to just, oh, fuck off. Fuck off. Or, you know, and invariably I'll say something like, I play a U.S. Marshal. And then it just goes downhill from
I was
there.
A marshal last season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I will continue to be a marshal this season.
What's different this season? Just different episodes.
Different actors.
From the last season.
Last season we had a certain story arc.
Yeah.
And then this season there's a different story arc.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've decided to not do the exact same episodes.
Most of the same actors. Some ones you haven't seen from the season
prior.
We're
going to shoot some stuff outdoors while continuing to shoot some things indoors as well.
Exactly. Otherwise it's, I realize it's ridiculous because I'm going to get that question.
Sure.
A dozen times in the coming weeks. But I just want you people to know that it pains me to answer it.
You know,
we got to put this out soon so they know.
Right. Here's a good way around that. You just stare into their eyes unblinkingly and go, well, my character doesn't like to be asked repetitive, generalized questions about things that the person asking them should probably do a little research on, and then just stare.
That's good.
And it's like, that's not me, of course.
No.
That's just
a character.
That's just a little background about the character that I'm playing. You never see it on screen, but that's really where I'm deriving a lot of the motivation.
Right. That's good. I like that.
Yeah, it skirts the issue, kind of sends a message, and it makes a nice uncomfortable moment.
Mm-hmm. I like that. That's good.
When you start working on something like Deadwood, you must have known when you read the script, like, oh yeah, this is going to be an exceptional piece of television. But did you really get a sense of that while you were doing it, or did it just feel like, we're in a job, there's
no,
a Western set?
No, I'm no dummy. I mean, I have a sense of when you read something that moves you, you know, in that case, you know, you find yourself a few pages in and you realize your mouth is open as you're reading it. You're kind of going, wow, this is, you know, as my mom said, when she saw it, she said, I thought you were doing a Western. And I said, it is what a Western. She says, not the ones I grew up watching. You know, I mean, I had that sense of it when I was reading it. I had a sense of, you know, and then I think day one on the set, David taking it to this other level of, you know, it took me a while to even kind of grasp how far he was taking it, and you know how familiar yet unfamiliar it was going to be. You know, it was. It took me a long time to realize he wasn't joking when he would start speaking and giving us direction.
Yeah,
and I. To this day, it's a tremendous source of inspiration. That experience working with David.
It was almost I don't know. I've never seen anything else like it. I don't know how else to describe it other than it's like a Shakespearean Western. Like everything, the dialogue. You had to be a good actor to make that to make that dialogue work because it was so intricate.
Yeah.
And I'm so fucking mad. I heard this awful story that everyone thought the show was coming back, and then HBO pulled some sort of a weird, crazy thing, and then it last minute, they're like, well, it's not coming back. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that was my experience. I remember it well because I had just bought a house.
Season three. We did three seasons, guys. Everyone loves the show. What, are we going to not come back?
I mean, it was so...
This is America.
It was so bizarre because during the course of season three, Ian and I were renegotiating our deals and renegotiating good faith. So we were literally 8 or 9 episodes in when we completed a renegotiation deal for that season we were shooting. You know, you always hear those dramas like, sure, they're not going to show up in the set until they have a deal, yeah, and yada. Well, we were kind of like, well, when the season started, we were still in the talks of renegotiating, and you know, the show was successful and we were going to get a bump and so on and so forth, especially in with a ridiculously well-deserved bump. But we were like, oh, you know, we're going to go to work and we're going to do the job and we're not a problem, and the people will continue to, you know, talk and go back and forth. And it got drawn out, no hurry. But so my point is, 8 episodes in or so, we completed a deal and got paid for those 8, you know, big paycheck for those 8-9 episodes we'd already shot.
Yeah.
And within 2 weeks later, they canceled the fucking show. So you're like, why'd you just give us all that money? Clearly, this was not on the agenda.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they would have just said, go fuck yourselves.
Right.
We're going to pay you what we're going to pay. So it was clear that nobody saw that sort of train wreck coming.
That's crazy.
Because, you know, I have the checks to prove it. I mean, there would be no reason, obviously, to give us a raise, you know, 3/4 of the way through the season. I really did buy, my wife and I bought a house, as I like to say, glass half full now. Thank God I didn't know they were going to cancel the show. I would have never bought this house. You know, I managed to stay in it. I shaved my head and went to Bulgaria to do a movie, but I managed to pay for the fucking house. people ask, are you going to do a second Hitman? You're like, no, we're good. We're good.
No, I'm still in the house.
We're good. We're in the house, and so far,
not doing a second Hitman.
But I remember getting, literally, moved in a few days, and early one morning, and David called me, and I said, bad news. He said, the show's over. And it was, you know, I don't want to give too much of that conversation away, but it sounded like, you know, they gave him a nudge and he said, or you could just go fuck yourself. You know, we'll just call it. And I think that was my understanding.
I don't
but,
know.
You know, it takes two people to make that big of an accident. So.
I don't know if this is true, but the rumor that I heard, and again, this is allegedly probably 10th hand information, but the rumor that I heard was that, you know, someone who was running the network at the time standed to get a huge bonus if HBO came in under a certain budget for the year.
I don't know about that.
Okay, good. I hope that's not the case.
Look, I think that. Here's what I think would be conventional wisdom on that issue, which is HBO, more importantly than Deadwood, would want to be in the David Milch business.
Sure.
Because he is a remarkable, remarkable talent. And he had sold them a show, which turned out to be John in Cincinnati, that they were very excited about in terms of the possibility and continue that relationship. Deadwood was an extremely expensive show.
Sure.
I mean, our call sheets were oftentimes, you know, day 15 of 11.
Right.
Like, what is that? That makes no sense. Day 15,
right.
What are we talking about? I mean, it was a television show that went months over and was, I mean, it was an unbelievable, but they gave him a lot of, you know, room, and it was very costly. And they didn't own it outright either.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that Paramount... I think, as I understand it, HBO and Paramount shared that. In order to work with David on that show, Paramount had a deal, and so there was something where they owned the domestic, but the other owned the foreign. So even the fact that it was a success, I don't know if it was such a huge financial. So I think there was some motivation to say, okay, this show is what it is,
yeah,
And perhaps we should start seeing the end of it soon and move on to what that network is about, which is the next great thing.
I just wish HBO would have said, we'll give you a little bit of money to do 1 2-hour episode to just fucking wrap it up. Like,
well, yeah, I think that in defense to all of that, I would say that while I'm sure there was good intentions and people still talk about it, the practicality of bringing together all those people to do that show sure. as it was originally conceived with all the players. I mean, it's hard to get 3-4 of us together for lunch. I don't know how you get 3-4 of us together for a few months and say, okay, we're going to do it and we're going to do it right here because you've got a window and you've got a window and David's got a thing and da-da-da-da-da and negotiate and everyone agreed to do it in some good spirit of, you know, how do you not negotiate? And it's just a very complicated, once it ends, it's very complicated to say, oh, now we want to do this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm an asshole. I just be like, fine, $7 million. They're like, what are you talking about? Hey, fuck you, $7 million. You want to make it? Let's go. You know what I mean? I'd be like, all right, you got someone else? Play it. Fucking let them play it. And then you're like, Billy Crudup's playing Bullock. All right, hold up a second.
Whoa.
What was I getting paid per episode again? Go back. I'll take
half of that.
That's good.
Let me back.
I'll tell you what, I'll do it for free. I just
want to be a part of it. I just want to be a part of it. It's really hard to put it together. I don't know. Anytime you read about a job you're doing for the first time, you hear about it in the trades, it's usually not going to happen. It just makes no sense. I've had a few times where I'm like, hey, honey, hear this? I'm doing a movie. And I've never been in that movie, ever. You know what I mean? Like, every now and then you get where it happens a lot, and you know, especially in the last decade or so with the internet. You're walking down, you show up to work, and they say, hey, I hear you're going to be the Lone Ranger. And you're like, no fucking way. That's great. That's fucking awesome. Hold up a second. They're like, we're ready for you on the set. Fuck you, man. You didn't just hear. I'm the lone fucking ranger, man. You are? Yeah. Who told you that? Fucking makeup. They're all talking about it in makeup. It's on fucking TV.com.
They must know because they're really in the business. Like, they hear
right
things.
Fucking there. Read about it. Now it's on like 12 websites. They can't all be wrong.
Oh, they were all sourcing the same. Oh.
Yes, exactly. So you call your agent. Is it Drew? I'm the lone fucking ranger? It's like, listen, man, I get Google alert. I see it. And that's the way Deadwood was. I mean, I literally, McShane and I were on the phone. He called me and said, hey, did you hear about this? I said, what? He says, we're doing a movie, Deadwood movie. I said, get the fuck out. He goes, it's in the trades. I was like, really? Huh. When are we doing it?
Oh, we already shot it.
What? We already shot it. It's great.
You don't remember you were
so,
there.
So, I mean, you know, come. It's.
It will always, Deadwood will always be one of my, like, there will always be a tiny hole in my heart where it's like, oh, I want to know what happened to Hearst and Calamity Jane was pulling it together and Seth was dealing with his anger and, you know. Like,
I'm sure if there's some fan fiction that would be just up to
snuff.
You know,
I'll tell you who
some erotic fan fiction that would be up to
snuff. I want
to
know what happened to the character who got kicked in the face by the horse. Like, I always, I'm going to be like, did they just carry him in a wheelbarrow?
That was Don Draper's dad.
So good. So good.
I just want to know.
Maybe there's a comic book in there somewhere. Someone could just wrap it up in a, you know, graphic novel.
I mean, you know, horrible racist gets kicked. I mean, like, I'm spoiling it now because if you haven't seen Deadwood by now, you should. And even if you hear this, you still should watch the series anyway. It's worth
by the way, when you say horrible racist gets kicked in the head by a horse, it still plays.
It's great. And
I want to see that as an Onion headline.
But just watching what happens with the character,
it's
like, with the relationship between him and Franklin Ajay's character.
Unbelievable.
That they like, it just,
you know what's amazing?
That side story is
if
amazing.
If you could only, why no one shot a making of document. I mean, I was on the set countless times, a couple days a week, where I said, why is no one filming this, watching David pull that shit out of the ether? I mean, just daily pulling that kind of stuff. He would come up to me and tell me, here's what's, it's going to be great. What happens at the, I remember season one, halfway through the show, he comes up to me and says, here's what's going to happen is, you remember that guy in the opening episode, wanted that dude, you're going to, and they wanted to tar, smother him, set him on fire. he shows up. He's kind of, that guy rides into Deadwood. He's lost everything. And he's going to, you know, he's got to start over. He's going to pan for gold. And he's starting from scratch. And when he sees you doing as well as you're doing, he would rather kill you than have to pick up a fucking pan. And you're like, that's awesome, you know? And then the next day, you're like, how's that coming? No, new thing. You're like, I mean, daily, awesomeness just pouring out of him. Wow. I mean, that kid getting, you know, the bullet kid.
Oh, God damn it.
Which becomes like the greatest, amazing, moving, emotional core of the second season. Is that what
yeah.
it is? You know, the... And I can't vouch for any truth to all of this. I can only tell you that hadn't been discussed at any time. And I showed up one day and someone said there was a rumor going around that the kid's mother was, and I'll keep it, was being a pain in the ass. And, you know, what the details of that aren't important, but because every kid's parent on a set is a pain in the ass. So we can trust that's a truth, right? That's a, every kid below 12 years old on a set has a parent who's a big pain in the fucking ass.
Yeah, they're probably a single parent. They probably hang out at the Daily
when
Grill on Laurel
Justified,
Canyon.
When we did Justified, we talked about Raylan having a kids because he has kids in the book. And then we thought, they're just going to be a pain in the ass. So we thought, let's not have him have kids. Maybe we'll have him have kids towards the third or fourth season if we're so lucky. And then the show will be over, and we won't have to deal with their parents. So anyway, there's this rumor going around that the mother's done something, and David's none too happy about it. And so you say, whatever, move on. And at lunch that day, I got a knock on my door, on my trailer, and open it up, it's David. And I say, what's up? He says, we're going to kill the kid.
Oh, my God.
And I said, really? He said, it's going to be great for you. Great, great story. Great story. It's going to be good for the kid. And on we went. I mean, that became this incredible story. And not to look, typical David, not unlike a lot of those stories, whether it was the preacher with the tumor and all that. He became fascinated with all of the everything and how it affected everybody, and it became the theater of the town. The kid's sure. death was like, oh, we didn't, you know, most television, you kill the kid and he's dead, and yeah. everybody sheds a tear, and the next week you got a new episode. David was like, no, we're going to kill the kid, and we're going to see every facet of that. We're going to see how it affects you and the family and the town. You're going to go into mourning. You're going to, they don't know when to take you out of mourning because the town needs you. I mean, it became this incredible, my character talking to the kid as if I'm his real father.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Based on, from what I understand, just some fucking woman who just pissed him off that morning.
That's great.
David sounds a little more like Swearengen's character in that sense. Like, oh, you fuck with me? All right.
I think David,
I'm gonna run over your kid with
David
a bunch of horses.
David has the part of the brilliance of, as far as I can tell, is that he sees no separation between the unconscious and conscious mind, and what happens at lunch, and what happens on the set, and what happens in the scene, and you know, I remember having lunch with him early when we started working and talking about getting in fights. And I told him when I was a kid, as late as like sixth grade or so, I used to get in a lot of fights. And I remember getting in fights and crying while fighting some kid. And the next day he's got a scene where Bullock's, you know, got his hands around, what's his name's neck, tears coming out of his eyes. Jack McCall, right? The guy who killed Wild Bill.
Oh, right.
That scene was written shortly after a conversation I had with him just talking about
growing up. Was that Garrett?
Yeah, Dillahunt.
Dillahunt,
amazing.
Yeah.
And that great line where he says, why are you crying, faggot? You know, I call him a droop-eyed motherfucker, and he says I was born that way. And I say, "What do you? How do you explain the rest of the fucking mess?" I mean, it was amazing stuff. I remember walking off the set with David. On the stage door, you go in through those double doors, and you go into, you know, from set light into extreme darkness, and then you open the door into the sunlight. And David walked right into the wall, really hit his head hard. I looked at him. It was just the two of us. I said, are you okay? And he looks over at me and says, "God damn it, if I couldn't become addicted to that." And that night, Pages came out, some character just banging his head over and over and over.
That's amazing. I think the one thing you never see in a Western, or like, you know, in that type of a show, is the emotional impact of the lifestyle that they lead. And seeing Swearingen's number one guy and Hearst's number one guy get in the most brutal street fight you've ever seen. And then in most Westerns, they would have been like, the one guy would have walked away and been like, yeah, whatever. And then watching what happened to him emotionally, when you think this character is impenetrable and you see what the real fallout of that is astonishing to see. I wish that Deadwood were an interactive, like, sandbox type game where you could just go in and just check in on different pairs of characters seeing what everyone's
doing.
That's
what it was on that set. I mean, that's exactly what he had. They gave him a street. It was fully operational. And he that's why I wish it was filmed, because it was his sandbox. And he was literally on the set shooting a scene with me saying, what episode is this? And then someone would whisper, you know, this is episode 5. He goes, before the Swearingen's going over to see Wu? Is that where we are? Yes, David. Are the Japanese here? Do we have the Japanese? And they're like, David wants Japanese. David, how soon can we get the Japanese? You know, what? We could have the Japanese here in an hour. Perfect. Perfect. What else can we shoot? Let's wait an hour. We'd like to have, you know, and it's a fucking sandbox.
Wow.
He's with his little soldiers. And he's like, 50% of it felt like it was thought through, and 50% of it was, oh, here's what we should do. You know, I got an idea.
That's amazing.
It was, and at the same time, he'd say, you know, it wouldn't be unlike him to say, what we really need here is Hawks, John Hawks. He should be in this. Do we have John Hawks? No, he's not available today. Perfect. What we need is, and then it would just be, the way kids play with their toys. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Wow.
I think in the sense that he understood that he had a very good idea of the story and the ideas, the things that were important to him that he was telling. So everything else was sort of, it felt like all the pieces could fit to tell that story to its fullest. I don't know. It was remarkable to be around.
Well, since you're on the creative side of Justified, did you take anything away from that?
As I think David Mamet once said, I think of a man smarter than me, and I ask myself, what would he do? And that's the game I'm playing on Justified. I just, I think to myself, all right, you know, there's an opportunity. It's been an opportunity for me to exercise that in theory anyway, that idea of saying, well, wait a second. You know, it's very hard for them to get rid of me on this show, you know? And so I'm able to kind of go in and say, I got an idea, you know, or what if we, you know, I got a question. I don't know. I feel like because I'm not one of the writers, so I have no pressure. You know, my name's not on the script. If it doesn't work, I think, well, shouldn't have let me fucking.
That's on you.
I'm just supposed to say my lines and hit my mark. I think there's a certain freedom that comes with it. The fact that technically I'm just supposed to, you know, be an actor on the show. And I think one of the hardest things that I've learned so much on the show. I think one of the most difficult things for writers on a television show is to not write defensively. I think the it's a very difficult the nature of the system of a writer's room. You know, when you're David and you have this singular voice and you've been given all that power, and you're as out of your mind as he is, and there are others like him, and so committed to your vision, I think that if it works, it's really going to work. I think what happens in the writer's room that's very difficult is you basically it's a job. You're trying to work for the network. You're trying to work for your boss. You're trying to, you know, rise above. And you're ultimately trying to please a certain people.
Sure.
And sometimes perhaps too many people. And I think invariably you end up thinking defensively, well, is he going to like that? Or is that what he wants?
Right.
And it's the kiss of fucking death every time. And it's a very funny thing that I didn't see coming. When I forced my way into that room and, you know, exercised my voice, it was so fun for me. But what starts to get created is people thinking, well, I don't know if Tim's going to like that. You know, I don't know if Tim thinks, and you just don't want him to think that way. And no. At the same time, you want him to do what you fucking want him to do.
It's sort of an unfair.
It's a totally unfair. It's ridiculously unfair. It's very, very difficult to be in that position and not fall into that trap. And by doing so, you lose the childlike sort of freedom and imagination to just fantasize and say, you know, where does this want to go? I know this is where we think it wants to go, but fuck that. I'm taking it this way.
I think I know part of the trick to that because you deal with it a lot when you're doing stand up, which is you're trying stuff, and you know some people aren't going to like stuff. And I think so. Any idea that you're pitching in a writer's room or whatever, you have to be okay with. You have to be comfortable with the fact that you're taking a risk, and some of your stuff is going to fail.
Yes.
So you just have to know that if it does fail, you fucking move on right away. Like, if I pitch you an idea and you go, I hate that, go, fine, here's another idea. Yeah, and, right. then, and if you don't linger on it,
right.
people can't focus on more than one thing at a time, so they're not going to go back and go, whoa, wait a minute, that last, that, you're like, hey, here's a new thing, great, you didn't like that, yes. here's something else. Like, you just have to be comfortable to not linger on it too long, and then
well,
I feel like they'll follow
I think
you.
In the, I think the thing you said that's the big deal is to be comfortable with failure.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember in acting school hearing this story about a guy, and I don't remember which one, but it's during that sort of fervent years of, you know, American theater and Strasberg and all those, you know, Sandy Meisner and put New York theater and American theater, and one of them giving a speech saying the problem was they were becoming too obsessed with success and trying to write plays that would be successful. And he ultimately was giving a speech where his big rally cry was, we need more failures. And we need more failures. Come on, people. And I find myself sounding a little bit like that on the set, which is, who gives a shit? I mean, really, what if we go for this and it doesn't work? Worst case scenario is what?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we it doesn't work, but boy, we took a swing.
Yeah.
If we don't go for it and it kind of works or it plays or something, so what? You know, so what? And I think it's really tough to get to that place to really trust your unconscious, to trust that to tell it in a look. You basically want approval. Basically what it comes down to. You're just constantly trying to get approval. And the easiest way to get approval is to do what works,
mm-hmm.
week in and week out. And the problem with that is it invariably becomes boring.
Sure.
And so you have to be willing to say, you know, look, what I'm trying desperately to do is write something fantastic that everybody loves. And the way I'm going to go about it is to do something that could be an absolute fucking disaster, you know, and I think that's it's a really tricky game to play, and still, especially when you're in a room and you're trying to impress and you're trying, you know, you eventually want to get your own show and run that show. It's very hard to get into that mindset of being that sort of free. I mean, when you think of those Milt stories, the idea of having a run in with some stage mother and then saying, okay, the whole season's now going to be about, we're going to kill that kid. And then we're going to, it just takes such a a level of sort of confidence and throwing caution to the wind. I go back to those stories constantly because I ask myself, what was the season going to be about? Right? And how, and I'm sure it was probably something fantastic, and easily could have said, okay, we're just going to deal with this issue and we're going to go forward with what we've got planned.
Yeah.
The fact that he was in a position to say, here's an opportunity.
Well, that's the key, is he has an improviser's mindset where it's like, it doesn't matter what you throw at me. I want to be able to make it work somehow. And that's having right. that level of confidence is yes. and comfort.
No, I think that's what you see when you mention like Louis C.K. and something that, you know, it's what he's done in recent years is just decide to throw up over on everybody.
Yeah.
And I think that that's just a very brave place to be. Mm-hmm. And the payoff is so great. But I think I remember watching him do stand up 15, 20 years ago in New York. I did stand up for like 6 months of my life.
You did? You did stand up?
Yeah.
In New York?
In New York. Yeah.
Holy shit.
And like at Boston and.
That's when the Boston comedy scene was fucking amazing.
That was. You know, I was going down there like open mic night and trying to get 5 minutes during the week, you know, at least like Monday through Thursday, and then it gets tough. And
God, you had Greg Giraldo and Bill Burr and guys like that.
Well, Dave Attell was hosting and Louis C.K. was hosting. Kevin Brennan was hosting. Sarah Silverman was doing like kind of like open mic, couple minutes. And Jay Moore was down there and Dave Chappelle was mm-hmm. just getting down there. He was like a kid telling stories about arriving in New York and Louis C.K. was doing like Superman, like Clark Superman walking through Washington Square Park going, no thank you, I'm okay, I don't do drugs, no thank you, I appreciate that. And I remember thinking, and he did like, you know, sounds in an elevator. Like he would just do like when you get in an elevator, what you really want to do is, and he'd start going, blah, 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 you know, and it was really funny, but it wasn't what obviously he started to do. What Dave Attell was doing then, what I feel in that regard, which is he was just saying shit up there that you're like, God, that's fucking funny, but I know who you are now.
Yeah.
I know you in a way. I mean, I remember Dave Attell walking up on stage and saying, literally just grabbing the mic and saying, my dad used to dress up as Santa Claus, rape me, and say, don't worry, Dave, I don't exist. And you're like, that's hello. You know what I mean? That's hello.
Let's start there.
Right away, you're like, wow, you've got my attention. You're telling me you've got 15 more minutes?
And it's in that gravelly voice.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
How was stand-up for you then? So you did it for 6 months, and then...
At least, actually, I probably did it much longer than that. I think there was a six-month period where I did it with a certain commitment. I think I probably dabbled, and then I did it for 6 months, and then I occasionally would go back, not sure what the fuck I was, you know, doing with it. It was great. It was, well, it was both great and, I don't want to do this. I mean, it was, but... you know, there was a stretch there in my mid-20s where, you know, I'd made some kind of commitment just to say, well, there's a thought, you know, do that, you know, give it a shot. It was some sort of like, let's try to avoid the midlife crisis. It was like a conscious decision to avoid a midlife crisis. So anything and everything that seemed like... something you know that like this is something I've always wanted to do. I'm gonna go at least, you know, scratch the surface and take a good look at it before I go get a job or have to get a job. And so, it was the first decision actually, stand up. I was a fine art major and I was painting and drawing and I needed to start thinking about, you know, work and a career. And I was thinking about getting an advertising, you know, job. Like, I remember like 30-something, that show. I thought, that could be my life. And that would be great. Those guys seem like they've got a great situation. They've got a basketball hoop in their office.
Yeah.
And that seems
They're doing okay. They have high-class problems.
They're creative.
They're quippy.
Yes, all of those things. And I thought, that's it. That's where I'm headed. And that was pretty good. But there was a part of me that's, with all due respect to people in that profession, I just thought, oh, my God, it's still a nightmare.
Yeah.
So I was applying to get my master's in fine arts and you know, see, well, maybe I could just be an artist, like literally galleries. You know, I was trying, people are constantly, I'm going on, but you know, when you get like, when I chose to get a fine art degree, I just did it because I could. I didn't think about what I was going to be.
Right.
I just remember visiting this, you know, the college and saying, what's going on over there? And they said, that's the fine art department. And I was like, what are you talking about? They said, you know, painting, drawing, sculpture. And I was like, you can get a degree in that? And they said, yeah. I was like, I'm in. I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, I spend hours drawing rather than doing my homework. So if I could actually get a degree, I mean, that's getting away with murder. But there was no plan beyond that. And then what people do invariably is when you're going to college, people say, so what are you going to do with that? And then you start answering at first you think, well, I could be an artist. And then they kind of squint. And then you think, oh, I could get like, you know, commercial design. And they nod their head. And you're like, okay, that's the answer. So you start, you know what I mean? You're like, I could get into, you know, advertising. And they say, aha, yes, yes. And so you think that's what you're going to become. And then I think when I, in my 20s, I realized, no, that's not what I want. Anyway, so stand-up was something I'd always thought of. So I got up once with a buddy of mine, and we went up, the two of us, literally down at the Laugh Factory in Santa Monica right after Jerry Seinfeld. And it was painful. I mean, it was 3 minutes of silence. But I thought, yeah, we should give it another shot. And he was like, you're on your own. So, then I went up at the Laugh Factory, and it went great. I mean, it really was one of those, you know, my experience was it went very well early. Moved to New York and went, you know, I got advice, go down to Boston and Boston Comedy. And I started doing it. And it was going pretty well. I think the problem with it was, I thought, you know, there's a lot of the things that I'd like to have in life, and this seems to be in complete contradiction of that. And maybe at the time I was just terrified of all of it, but I think I felt like I was just going to be, I was losing a sense of, I mean, it was early on, but my wife, we were married, and I just felt like, well, these hours are not useful. This mentality is a very difficult, it's a very difficult energy to try to maintain. I mean, comedians are very difficult to fucking hang out with. I mean, they really are. I mean, it's such a constant one-upsmanship and a constant feeling of is that funny? And it's very difficult to put that aside. And
yeah.
And I felt like it was really taxing as much as it was a drug. And I also thought, I'm going to be in best case scenario, I'm on a sitcom and done. And the whole thing's over in like 7 years.
Right.
I just was really concerned that.
You saw the ceiling.
I saw the ceiling. And I thought, but you know, looking back, I mean, I think a lot of it was just fear, because sometimes you get so wrapped up in making these smart decisions and being thoughtful and stuff, and then you're in a movie and the star was like in the WWF, and you think, what was I so fucking concerned about? You know what I mean? Like, he's got the star of the movie and he was a wrestler, and I was busy taking classes and trying to be thoughtful. So, I mean, I think that, but anyway, it was cool. It was great. And, but I think that it nudged me towards like, maybe I should go take some acting classes and just give myself a little wiggle room.
I'm happy to hear the comedy went well, because I would guess like you might be too handsome to be a stand-up. Like, there's almost,
I got shit for it, you know, but yeah.
There's almost a little, you know, like the.
I mean, I.
A comedian.
Thank you,
no,
by
of course.
The way. I appreciate that.
A comedian has.
You're pretty handsome to be a stand up as well, young man.
Well, I was fishing.
I really felt like I was.
Time to put
that.
The reel away. Yeah. Close the tackle box.
I'll leave you guys alone.
This fishing trip is
over.
Bar.
No, that's right.
Jonah looks like a comic. Like, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. If I put a hat on, I look like a comedy writer. That's just how it goes. Yeah.
I
need to put on a suit and some tennis shoes.
I was a huge. I was like a student of like the Steve Martin and of the. I really thought, you know, I was going to do something sort of heady and smart and.
I've wanted that for so long to try to write Steve Martin style because you know I knew every album back to front and. I mean, I could recite Comedy Is Not Pretty and Cruel Shoes and all these great and
play the banjo parts at the Steve Martin
could
Brothers.
Never play the banjo parts. Yeah. Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
I opened with If You Love Me and You Know It, Clap Your Hands. And I thought that was in my mind, I was like, that's pretty fucking Steve
Martin.
Steve Martin. I mean, I'm going right to the thing. Like, let's just get this out of the way. And can I just open with, do you love me? And then tell jokes? That was my premise.
Steve wore a white suit and a black tie. I'm going to wear a blue suit and a black tie.
Yeah. It's but a little I bit thought, different. And then I think I told some Martin pornography jokes. I mean, I really went for the.
You spend that first period of time trying to write those kind of jokes, and you're like, oh yeah, this is impossible. I can't fucking. I don't know how that. He just wrote that because that was his take on the zeitgeist of the Vegas performer and the like.
Yeah.
There was a level that worked if you didn't get what he was doing, and if you got what he was doing, it's like a whole other brilliant, ironic level of writing and. It just he was just that magical combination, right time, right era, right.
No, it was he's pretty special.
Right everything, yeah. And the one guy that I've kind of been like, I thought I wanted him on the podcast, and then I was like, I don't know if I could do it because I might just be too
Steve Martin.
Yeah.
I met him once and I did one of those like where I overlaughed. I actually met him a couple times. I auditioned for Picasso and
Looking to Gilles, yeah.
And so I went down to this, and it was like a experience I'd never had before. I was literally in a theater on the stage, and they were Steve Martin and the director and the producer were all kind of in the theater, sitting down in the dark. And I went up, I auditioned for Elvis, and I remember after I did my read, I read through it. He said the director said something, and I said, "You mean like?" And then Steve said something. And I said, oh, you mean like blah, blah, blah. And he said, yeah, like blah, 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 blah. And in my head, all I remember thinking is, we're collaborating. I don't even recall what he said other than, and me saying, oh, you mean like la, la, la. You know, he's like, oh, maybe, you know.
So it could have been like, so you mean whatever. I'm not right for this part.
And he
yes,
says,
you're
yes,
not
like
right
that.
For this part.
And I thought, wow. So we just had this thing that we just clearly were seeing something the same. And then... read a couple times and then I left and I left my bag back in the theater and I walked back in the theater and I said sorry and it's embarrassing. I pick up my bag and I leave. So it was like one of those second see you, thank you, great. And then you walk out and then you come back in and say, oh, can I just? And as I left, he's like, you can turn the tape recorder off now. Like I left a tape recorder in my bag and tape recorded their conversation after I'd left. And I thought, that was really funny and witty, and never thought about that. I should do that. Leave my bag with a tape recorder, and I hear what they say. And then I didn't get the part. Years later, I was doing a play off Broadway, and he was friends with one of the actors, Bruce Norris. You know, he went on to become a writer and won a Pulitzer, right? His brother was the guy on MTV, did the news.
Oh, John Norris.
John Norris. So is it Bruce is the actor and John is the news guy, right?
John was the news guy,
so
yeah.
So Bruce has since become a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright and a very funny, witty guy. And he was in the play and Steve showed up and came back backstage and was like hanging out with all of us. And he said something, someone said something about one of the cast members being sick the night before. And it was good that you came tonight because one of the other cast members in this four-person play wasn't here last night. And Steve said, oh, so did you just do the play without that part, or something like that? And I was like, ha, 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 ha. And I realized I'm laughing way too hard. And he And then he invited us all for drinks. And he said, you guys want to, we're going to go have drinks and you're all invited. And we walked around a few blocks and went into a bar there in Broadway. And he sat with all of us for the night, like for a few hours. And I didn't speak. I just kept my distance. I was like, this
smart.
Is, well, I just thought this is, I could feel.
Well, you put the arrow through the head, right? And you put the bunny ears on. And then
I kept saying, that's crazy. And he would say, hey, you know, I think I'm going to have a beer. What are you going to have? I was like, no way, that's crazy. And they escorted me out. But it was just great to be, you know, it was a monumental, those are big experiences.
I love that. I had no idea. I love that this is, I mean, I will bond about Steve Martin for forever. I mean, we're out of time now. We're almost at the end, but this has been really great. I'm so, you know, I'm sorry I didn't stumble across the stand-up past earlier on. We have like,
there's not much to stumble over. I mean, that was question, it. Yeah. I just, that's not, it doesn't come up a lot. I don't think I've ever. But
are there any
what a scoop.
Is there any video of that anywhere? There must be.
I don't think so.
Don't think so or don't hope
someone
so.
Will find
no,
it.
No, no.
You good
listen,
with it?
No, I'm. Listen, I've there's one thing I'm guilty of. It's being a big fan of my own work. you know, people ask if you're uncomfortable watching your work, and I'm like, no. I fucking sit in the theater and I nudge my wife. I was like, wait for this. Watch this part. Watch this part coming up right here. Yeah. Watch this part.
I don't mind watching stuff.
And you say the lines
along
that? With yourself.
Was that not good? Did you see that?
I figured out a better way to say that. I'm going to do when we get home, I'm going to show you how.
Watch this thing coming up here. I don't even have any dialogue, but watch the moment. Watch it. Yeah. Watch it. That wasn't written. That's just the, you know.
See that wink? All me.
Clap if you love me.
Yeah.
See, that's the opening.
That's that was actually good comedy. Offense, that was actually who you were. That's actually.
Well, you know, it was an idea. It played no matter what to some degree. If people clapped, if one person, if three people, four people clapped, you're like every time it didn't matter. You'd say you walk up, you grab the mic, you say if you love me and you know it, clap your hands. And if it's dead silence,
hilarious.
Or if one person claps, it doesn't matter. Regardless, all I would say is thank you and continue on and to go on. And I felt the only thing I felt was never why it was never reached its heights is because I've realized that a real comic would take that and go on for 3 minutes. I bet you could get 3 minutes out of that one premise. I remember thinking, oh, I've got it's an opening line, but I think I kept remember thinking going, I should be able to sing that song in various forms. For on and on.
I think it's a better opening line because it just sets the tone. And then
you don't think you just keep going?
You could.
If you blah, blah, blah for whatever, clap your hands.
You could. I think.
Da, da, da.
One quick line.
If you like little girls and granimals, clap your hands.
You're writing it now. Get the fuck back on stage. The Justified Comedy Tour. Who wouldn't go to that?
There you go.
CK and Oliphant performing.
Yeah. Let me know next time you go up. I'll see if I can get on the opening bill. I give you 1.5 minutes. Pure gold.
Justified comes back January 8th. And you should fucking watch it because it's a great show. And that's it. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having
Thanks,
me.
Man.
Thanks.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.